CSS has a weird place on the web today. There's a lot of polarization, with the opinion being seemingly split on CSS sucks and CSS rules, learn it better, fools. And I empathize with the CSS rules camp, and I'll explain why. I have a theory as to why the CSS sucks camp have the attitude that they do. I think it's a combination of them over-engineering their CSS, not fully understanding the power of CSS, and finally, approaching it like it's a language, like JavaScript, and expecting it to work in the same way. So what I'm going to do in this session is tackle the first bit and talk to you all about how we can simplify CSS to give us incredible power while also being as low-tech as possible. And the secret sauce is that most of the content isn't actually about CSS, but that all becomes clearer later. Let's talk about scale. Scale is bollocks most of the time, and I absolutely hate it when we use the term scale. But I think we're stuck with it, just like we're stuck with Jamstack, serverless, and performant. They're all equally awful words, but one thing they do is create a common, recognizable construct for communication. And as much as it pained me, it's exactly why I named this session Keeping It Simple with CSS That Scales. You probably knew before I even opened my gob that I'd be talking about working on massive code bases, which at some point we'll get to in this talk too. One thing that I do get pissed off about with scale though is that it gets slightly muddied when people use it as an excuse to over-engineer something. Let's take this common example. It usually gets said by some Bay Area tech bro. We use CSS in JS library because our product needs to scale. And let's be honest for a moment, folks. Most of the tepid guff that these tech bros are making will only scale as far as the bin, so it's not much of a valid excuse, is it? I'll also be bold and straight up and say that I don't think using scale as an excuse for over-engineering stuff, especially CSS, is acceptable, even for huge teams that work on huge products. Keep that in mind, because I hope by the end of this session you're going to be in agreement with me on that. Four key things. I think we can focus on four key things today, and for the rest of this talk, I'm going to run through them in detail, a little progress thing, so you know roughly how much longer you have to endure me for. And I could package this up as DCCS and really mop up the upvotes on that orange website, right? Anyway, let's dive in. Don't panic. One of my favorite books is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's about the Earth being blown up to make way for a hyperspace highway, and our main character, Arthur Dent, proceeds to hitchhike around space with his alien guide, Ford Prefect. And I know that's a proper rubbish synopsis, but you didn't come here to read me chatting about this book. The actual Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a sort of interactive encyclopedia. Well, interactive by 1979 standards. And the thing that's always resonated with me about the encyclopedia is on the cover it says, "Don't panic." The phrase is used so many times throughout the story, even when the context very much calls for panic. And I find myself really resonating with Ford Prefect, guiding Arthur Dent, a bumbling Brit, through the understandably mind-boggling adventure in space. Ford always approaches challenges in a calm, pragmatic way, just like the guy tells him to. Don't panic. And I think that's a takeaway for us too. In fact, when Arthur first gets the book handed to him, he says, "I like the cover. Don't panic. It's the first helpful or intelligible thing anybody said to me all day." Right, anyway, I'm digressing. Don't panic. It's such good advice because when we panic, we make silly mistakes. Think about it. How many horrendous CSS hacks have you made when you're up against it in a project and you just needed to get it done? See, a lot of people do it, and because we're panicking, their deadline is looming, and there's not time to work out why our CSS is balked, so we throw important rules at everything until it's fixed. And that's fine, we all do it, but what isn't fine is technical debt. Often panic goes beyond a little hack here and there and escalates into something much more serious, like employing a CSS and JS framework, which is the equivalent of taking out a Wonga loan to pay off your house mortgage. Incredibly high-interest technical debt, which frustratingly, the developers who took it out only pay a bit off, because it's mainly the user who takes the biggest hit in terms of performance. And this boggles my mind when you consider what we have available to us with modern CSS. The current state of CSS. Really, we've never had it better with CSS. We have CSS Grid with 93% support, Flexbox with 98.8% support, and approaching using them with a safe progressive enhancement mindset, and your layout is sorted. Job done. No worries. We also get CSS custom properties, which are native CSS variables, and they're incredibly handy for tokenizing our CSS. Because they are also affected by the cascade, we can override them contextually. This makes them useful for theming, algorithms, and display modes, such as dark mode. They're also just a subset of powerful features, but you can see how modern CSS is an incredibly powerful and effective styling tool. But it can also come up a bit short, especially when you do have lots of CSS to work with. So let's have a look how we can deal with that. SAS for the win. All of this native functionality is cool as heck, right? Let's not forget native nesting too. But who does all the work when we use that? Yep, the browser. In most cases, that's fine. Although the thought of native CSS terrifies me, especially when we're already kludging up the browser with heavy JavaScript frameworks. Basically, what I'm saying is we don't have to abandon SAS because native language features are coming. It's probably better to cautiously pre-compile your CSS and not force the browser to work as hard. It's already working hard enough, re-rendering the DOM every time one piece of data changes. Cough, React frameworks, cough. So why make it work harder just so you can have native nesting? It smells like developer experience over user experience to me. And we rush to throw stuff in the bin without thinking about the wider implications. Yeah, we'll get nested soon, but how is a low-powered device going to handle 5 levels of nesting with chain selectors? How is a low-powered device going to handle calculating the color of a custom property that's been overridden by the cascade 5 times? It doesn't matter how good the native tools are, because if you keep throwing rubbish code at browsers, it's the users that will suffer for it. And the beauty of SAS is that you get the best of both worlds. You get cool stuff like nesting, but if you do it right, you get nice flat selectors. You also get components, and if you want, you can set your project up to get multiple bundles. You can also lint your CSS at build time, so you know when stuff is getting out of hand, right in your terminal or GUI. And the most important thing is that with SAS, well, SCSS, you're writing CSS still. SCSS is smart enough to do just what it needs to focus on and leave the rest of your CSS alone. And to me, it feels like a pretty perfect setup. Communicate. We seem to be in an era where tools and methodologies are dreamed up to help avoid communicating with each other. Generated CSS class names is a classic example of this. And do you know how to get around naming collisions like a human? A bit like this. So imagine this situation. Developer 1 Lucretia says, "This component I came up with already exists. Let me have a quick look in Git to see who created it." Ah, it was Isabella. "Hey Isabella, is there a reason why this component is called block?" And of course, Isabella responds with, "Ah yes, it's a very important reason. How about you call it box instead?" And let's break this situation down. There could be several immovable situations that cause this to happen. It could be a design decision, a stakeholder decision, or a legacy codebase issue. And that's fine. And because Isabella, a competent professional, suggests an alternative to Lucretia, the situation is resolved almost immediately. And that, how wholesome is that? It's amazing what happens when we actually talk to each other. And so-called soft skills, which I prefer to call core skills, are shunned in favor of being able to build your own linked list or do fizzbuzz on a whiteboard. And this winds me up because to be an effective member of a team, you have to be able to communicate. Whereas the only time you ever do fizzbuzz in the real world is during that life-draining interview process. Documentation is everything. Another incredible way to communicate that's not actual talking is writing. I love writing, and as you probably noticed, I do a lot of it. In fact, I write almost everything down because I never know when I might need it. It also helps me to commit stuff to memory. There's a real value in writing everything down, especially in a large team of front-end developers writing CSS, or any code really. And you can document your thought process and explain how and why what you've done and why you've done things. You can write documentation so if another developer picks up your code, they know what's going on. And by documentation, I don't mean that you have to read reams and reams of structured docs. I'm talking about goddamn comments in your code. Take this example. There's a card with background color set to white with an important flag on it. And if I landed on this, I'd be like, what the heck is going on here? How about this though? That same CSS rule has a comment above it, which reads, when this card is used in the legacy app, there is a collision between existing styles. So unfortunately, it had to go nuclear. It's certainly a refactor target. Now, if I landed on that, I'd be much more like, well, fair enough, I've got a spare bit of time today. Maybe I should see if I can work out the specificity issue. Because good written communication can prevent unnecessary collisions between people, which can in turn prevent expensive technical debt created by silly tools. A win-win in my books. Right, enough of me yammering on about how to be a functioning adult for a minute, because I'm this far into this piece and I've not talked about how to write CSS yet. So let's do it. Consistency. I think consistency is the key to scaling CSS. Sorry, I said scale again. Really, this is what these over abstractions are trying to give you, in my opinion. They just go way too far. I use a methodology that is sort of a devolution of BEM, a simplified version, and I call it CBUT, which stands for Cascade, Block, Element, Utility, and Token. It's a probably rubbish name, I know, but it suits the rest of the awful stuff that we come up with for names, doesn't it? And I'll explain how CBUT works. Cascade. The C in CSS stands for cascading. Cascade is my favorite part of CSS because if you use it right, you can write very little CSS and get really good results in return. With this methodology, cascade is the first port of call. I set sensible defaults, high level theming and typography as high up as I can, and this gives us so much power. The components can then be much more skeletal and deal only with how they are different from the globals, rather than dealing with everything. Block. This is your component, your card or your button. It's the building block of a user interface, and that's about it really. It's a construct and nothing else. Element. This is something that's dependent of your block, a child element. It always lives in its parent block, and a good example of this is within your card. You might have a card image element. And I try to keep these elemental classes as light as possible and use CSS algorithms to distribute content rather than dive in even deeper. Again, this keeps our component files light and skeletal. An example here shows that I'm adding one rem of space between child elements and this sub-element. And I do that by using the lobotomized owl selector to select only the child elements to apply that space. And that means that any element could have that space. It doesn't matter what I put in that element. Utility. This is a class that does one job and does it well, like a plumber or a tin opener. An example of a utility class is one that centers text or applies some top margin. Simple, low fidelity tools. Importantly, it means you can write common CSS and apply it wherever you need it, rather than repeating yourself over and over again. Token. This is actually a utility class, but a specific utility class that implements a design token. And what's a design token, the screen? I'll let my pal Gina explain them because they invented them. Design tokens are the visual atoms of the design system. Specifically, they are named entities that store visual design attributes. We use them in place of hard-coded values in order to maintain a scalable and consistent visual system. So these little classes are great for decoupling the scaffold of your UI from the design system itself. It enables the system to live away from the code context that you're in, which gives us great power. The text 600 token is a reference to a size scale, just like this one off my website. It uses a major third scale, which gives us that lovely curve between sizes. And it's used for everything too. I use it for sizing text, spacing elements, and adding inner padding. And that's it really. I won't sit here telling you that's the best way to write CSS because it probably isn't. What it is though is it's consistent, just like BEM or its CSSs. And at the end of the day, find something that works for your team, stick to it, and then document the hell out of it. Enable people in your team to make consistent decisions without slowing them down. One thing I will say about methodologies, if you find yourself restricted by one, invest the time to experiment with something different. Things change, so accept that and embrace the fact. It's why I now use CBUT rather than BEM. I think BEM is amazing, but I also ran into issues where my modifiers were getting out of hand. So I sat back, simplified what I was trying to achieve, and settled on using utilities and tokens instead. Always be open to change. We live in a dynamic world and work in an incredibly dynamic industry. If you stick to your guns too tightly, you're probably going to end up causing more problems, not just for yourself, but for everyone else in the future. Simplification. It'd be wild if I did a presentation titled Keeping It Simple with CSS to Scales and didn't talk about simplification, wouldn't it? So let's start by talking about frameworks. Do you really need one? I don't think you do anymore. Bootstrap is an incredibly powerful framework. It came at a time when we were learning how to build responsive websites and fighting relentless compatibility issues with browsers. It was a hellish time, and Bootstrap, to its credit, made it all much easier. In fact, I'd go as far as saying that by accident, Bootstrap is one of the best design systems ever created. But using Bootstrap today, when we have actual native tools for layout, such as Grid and Flex, is like using a sledgehammer to crack an egg. It can also bring complications of its own too. Because of the way it's built, it uses very global selectors to aggressively set styles. And this results in stuff like the example we talked about before, where the background color was set as white with an important flag. And the same goes for most CSS frameworks, to be honest. An example that gives me a heart attack is Tailwind CSS. Generates over 40,000 lines of CSS by default, and that's bonkers. If you have a solid methodology like BEM, It's CSS, SMAX, or even CBUT, you could sprinkle a bit of grid system with, you know, grid, add some layout helpers with flex, and you're golden. And this is the approach that we took with Every Layout, a book that I co-authored with my good pal Hayden Pickering. For our layouts, we find the most robust solution by simplifying and distilling the problem. We then hint the browser using axioms and rudiments rather than micromanaging it to allow it to call shots. This results in very solid layouts that work upwards with progressive enhancement at the forefront. And it's been a really cool project and resonated with a lot of people, so go ahead and check it out. And on the subject of progressive enhancement, gather round and take a knee for a moment, everyone. Don't dismiss modern CSS because you have to support IE11. It's a ridiculous mindset, and it pisses me off whenever someone shares a cool trick on Twitter and a Chad will pop up in the comments with, "What about IE11 though?" Stop trying to pixel push your designs and instead use progressive enhancement to create a sensible default that automatically improves where support is available. Take this example. We've got a nice three-color grid system, and in times gone by, we'd employ some hacks, not just to lay it out, but also make it look like this in every single browser. And what I propose is that we take a step back, simplify the problem, and find a sensible baseline. So here it is, good old stacking with space. We let the elements sit on top of each other with a max width. And it gives us a 100% coverage with tiny amounts of CSS. With a handy little grid system that uses min-max to distribute columns, it means that we get a responsive grid with no media queries. But grid still isn't fully supported, so thanks to CSS's nature, it'll ignore stuff it doesn't understand and move on. So we can add this below our grid code, which is the code that sets the max width, add some auto margin to the left and right, and then add some margin to the top of siblings using the owl selector. And now, thanks to at supports, we can reset some of that where there is support, because if a browser supports grid, it also supports at supports. So job done. 22 lines of CSS with no hacks, and it works all the way back to IE9 and probably beyond. Slow down. The last point on simplification, and really the last point of this presentation before I wrap up, is slow down. Seriously, slow down. I know it's hard when you're working sprint to sprint on a massive project, but trust me, when shit hits the fan, just slow down. I came a cropper to this earlier in the year. I was working on a massive system and pattern library, and we were hit with some early complications. What I should have done was stop, step back, and put some critical thinking in place. But what I did instead was plow on through each sprint, each retro, and each planning session until it got to the point where not slowing down had massive negative implications. I was cashing tech debt like I was earning air miles on it. We had two or three grid systems, some fluid type and some utility-driven type that conflicted, and a card component that is pretty much a website in itself. If I had slowed down and stepped back, I could have seen these problems, but I didn't. So seriously, slow down and you'll save so much time. And I'll leave you with this take-home advice. Instead of moving fast and breaking things, move slowly and deliberately instead.